I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The hot weather is out in full force this week. I like the outdoors as much as anybody, but sometimes I like to find some shade and crack open a good book. This hour, we'll talk with the authors of some of the books on my summertime reading list as we check out the first edition of Steve's Bookshelf. We're taking a look at a slice of American history from revolutionaries to doughboys with some 1960s Americana on the side. Later, Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today it's Steve's Bookshelf and a look at some books I'm looking forward to spending more time with this summer. We'll begin with Joseph Ellis's Revolutionary Summer and a look at just how bleak American prospects were during the summer of 76. Then we turn to author Michael Perry's look at what an 82-year-old man whose favorite hobby is firing his homemade cannons can teach us about life, love, and artillery. Finally, with next year marking the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, we look at the new book, The Last of the Doughboys, and author Richard Rubin's search for the final survivors of World War I. But we begin with one of my all-time favorite guests here, Joe Ellis, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Founding Brothers, which is simply one of the finest books on our founding fathers ever written. He's back with Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence, and it's a close examination of the events of the summer of 1776 when things were looking so very bleak. And Joe Ellis, welcome back to Up to Date. Always good to have you here.
Steve, thanks for being a fan. I need your support out there in Kansas City.
Well, you've got one right here, and I hope a lot of other listeners will chime in as well here too, Joe. Just how bleak were things for the for Americans that summer of 76, Joe?
Well, in the summer of 76, they finally reached consensus that they were going to secede from the British Empire, but that meant that they were going to have to defeat the greatest military force on the planet, the British Army and Navy. And at least initially, the prospects of that succeeding were pretty bleak. And the book looks at two sides of the story here, mm-hmm. the political side centered in the Continental Congress, leading eventually to the Declaration of Independence, and the Continental Army on the other side, which is going to have to engage a rather sizable 42,000 soldiers and sailors, British force, that's invading New York, landing in Staten Island. And the average experience of a soldier in the Continental Army was about 4 months, and the average experience of a soldier in the British Army was 7 years. And and if you think about it, the British Army only lost two wars between 1750 and 1950. One was the American Revolution, and the other was the war against Afghanistan in the 19th century. Hmm. So they had an impossible task. And it turns out that New York was really indefensible. It's an archipelago, and the British Navy gave it an incredible advantage. So that the American Army starts with like 28,000 troops, half of the militia, and ends up with about 5,000. Hmm. A series of incredible and difficult defeats, and it's actually a miracle that they get off the archipelago and survive. So it's a kind of, it's not the best time for Washington either. His decisions aren't good. He's not a good tactician. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to command an army that is not really an army yet. So it's really a perilous moment, and there's a lot of improvisation going on, and the book tries to capture the excitement, the frustration, the danger, with some degree of drama.
You know, Joe, that year, 1776, the British dispatched the largest armada ever to cross the Atlantic Ocean to crush the Americans. What was their aim? What were they going to try to do to the American forces?
They basically decided that they were not going to allow these colonies to leave the empire. There was an option open to them, and if they had taken it, they would have been much better off, that is the British. They could have essentially created a version of the British Commonwealth 100 years earlier than it existed by allowing the colonial legislatures to continue to tax and legislate for themselves and remaining, but remain within the empire economically and under the authority of the king. They decided not to do that. They were the reason this force is being dispatched in the spring of 76 is they want to crush this rebellion in the cradle.
Mm-hmm.
They want to humiliate the American army, capture or annihilate it, and then break the will of the cause, as it's called, the rebellion.
And they think they could do that pretty easily. Joe, you're saying the British could have compromised, and they essentially backed away from that idea.
That's right. It's an early version of the domino theory, Steve. They thought if we allow the American colonies to take on this new status as kind of semi-independent, what does that mean for our holdings in Ireland and Scotland and India? They also believed that there had to be a single source of sovereignty in the empire. It had to be Parliament and the king. And you couldn't have the legislatures of each colony claiming sovereignty over its own internal affairs. And finally, they didn't think they really needed to do it because they thought they had the military power to squash this thing without much problem.
Joe, just how close did George Washington and his troops come to being absolutely annihilated by the British up in New York?
Twice, real close. Once they get the British attack from Staten Island to Long Island, and they trap the American army on Long Island. And if you, again, look at a map, the East River separates Long Island from Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
The British control the rivers and Long Island Sound, and it's a miracle. It takes a perfect storm of good things from the American point of view to allow them to get off at night. It's an early version of Dunkirk. And if they hadn't gotten off that night, they would have all been killed or captured. And it happens again on Manhattan in a battle called Kips Bay. They're routed, and again the British could have plugged the gap at northern Manhattan and trapped them there, and they didn't do that, and they almost let them get away. So this is the most perilous moment in the war, and in Washington on several occasions is right out there in front of his troops and 50 meters from British, and they're firing at him, and it's again another what he called a standing miracle that he wasn't killed.
We're visiting with Joseph Ellis about his new book, Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. Who comes out looking good in this book, Joe, and whose image takes a hit?
Well, I think that actually Washington takes a hit for deciding to defend New York in the first place. It was indefensible. He's probably the greatest general in American history that lost more battles than he won. and I'm an admirer of him, so I'm not offering this in some kind of insidious fashion. John Adams comes out looking pretty good because within the Congress, he's the one pressing for independence and insisting that there will be no reconciliation. As he says, the Messiah will never come.
And you say that about John Adams, even though at one point he talks about how he's not wild about the idea of giving poor men the right to vote.
He believes that the American Revolution has implications that are very liberal. I mean, giving the vote to people without property, ending slavery, giving women rights. These are all implicit in the values the American Revolution claims to stand for. But he says we have to delay those because we have to focus on the consensus on independence. If we insist on the slavery issue now, South Carolina is going to leave us, and we're not going to have a union. We're not going to have the consensus we need. So he's a believer in a kind of Burkean view of revolution, a kind of evolutionary view of revolution. We will win the war, and then we will begin to implement these other reforms.
Who else comes out looking good and maybe not so good in this book, Joe?
There's an American general called Nathaniel Greene, mm-hmm. who looks really good. He's the guy who keeps telling Washington, we need to get off this archipelago. He's a Quaker who has no military experience, and now he's a general, an impossible idea in the British Army. And he dies in 1785. If he hadn't died, he would have been one of the most famous founders. He would have become a major figure, probably a president. His stature and his correspondence at this time, he's one of the sanest and most sensible people.
You know, what was the turning point in the summer of 1776? By the time you get through August and September, what's the pivot point? How are things looking for the Americans at that point, Joe?
They're trapped on Manhattan, and the turning point is a decision by General Howe, the British military commander. His brother Richard Howe is the admiral. That they're not going to try. That their goal is not going to be to capture and destroy the army, the Continental Army. They're going to just occupy New York, the city, which is down way down at the southern end of Manhattan, and make it the port and base for the British Army and Navy for the rest of the war. That decision is the last chance that the British are going to have to ever end the war quickly. If they had made a different decision, and several generals wanted to make a different decision, and trap the army, trap the Continental Army, and annihilate it, I don't know what would have happened. I mean, it's in one of those unanswerable questions. I mean, what would have happened if Washington and his entire army were forced to surrender and or were annihilated? And you don't know the answer to that, but it didn't happen, and they escaped and eventually get to White Plains, and then they're out of the trap.
Hmm. You've written, obviously, so much about this time. What has made you to come back time and time again to the Revolutionary period?
People ask me that, Steve, and I give them my Willie Sutton answer. Willie Sutton was a famous bank robber
in the 50s
and a lovable guy. Keeps getting caught and put in the pokey, and they asked Willie why he kept robbing banks, and he said because that's where they keep the money. And in the late 18th century, this is where the ideas and values and institutions that currently and continue to be our values were first discovered and established. And so it's like the big bang moment in American history, that all the intellectual and political energy radiates out from that. We're now the oldest enduring republic in world history, and that's where we get created.
Hmm. You know, I know you're asked this a lot, but how would the founders react to the America of 2013 if they could even glimpse it for a day or two? What do you think they would say about us?
It's hard to say that. I mean, they wouldn't understand our world at all, and trying to bring them into the present is sort of like trying to plant cut flowers that won't really work. But I remember an L.A. Times op-ed woman asked me to write a piece on when the Iraq War was beginning to gear up, and what would Washington think of that? And I said, well, he wouldn't know where Iraq was. And and she said, yeah, but we want you to write something. So I wrote something. And what I basically said that answers your question in one sense, at least, is he would have said, we've become the British. The Americans are now an imperial power. Now, if you ask almost all American citizens if we're an empire, they would say no. But if you ask anybody else in the world, they would say yes, of course they are. And I think there's a real question here, whether a republic can be an empire. Hmm. A republic is built on the principle of consent, and an empire is built on the principle of coercion. And I think that Washington and many of our founders would have trouble understanding the size of our military and our role as an imperial power in the world.
Oh, that's interesting. Joe Ellis's new book, Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. Joe, it's always good to have you here. You're welcome on Up to Date anytime, and appreciate you taking some time with us.
Steve, thanks for having me. The book's selling pretty well, so tell people out there to grab it while they can.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks again. Now the life lessons of Tom Hartwig, the 82-year-old man whose favorite hobby is firing his homemade cannons. Author Michael Perry's book is titled Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. He's also the author of a book I'm just loving right now, Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time, which is a memoir of Michael's work as a volunteer firefighter in his hometown of New Auburn, Wisconsin. As if being an author isn't enough, Michael Perry hosts the nationally syndicated Tent Show Radio. He performs widely as a humorist and tours with his band, The Long Beds. And Michael Perry, so good to have you here. Good morning.
Well, howdy. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, man, you can really write. And I'm wondering, are you still working as a volunteer firefighter, too?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I have my pager on right now, as a matter of fact. So I'm working with the Volunteer Fire Service here as a first responder. I've been an EMT or first responder for over 20 years and volunteer firefighter for 12.
I gather you must like it a lot.
I do. You know, the thing I always say about the firefighting and the EMS work especially is that I'm in a lucky knucklehead. I never planned on any of this stuff, and I get to travel around and tell stories and talk to folks about my books. But I still live in a very rural setting, and I depend on my neighbors. And when I'm gone, if something goes wrong at home, it'll be my neighbors who will be coming to help. And so for me, when I get back home from book tour or performing, it's just a privilege to put the pager on and try to do my part and hopefully pay that forward a little bit.
I gather you still hold the distinction as the only member of the New Auburn Area Fire Department who ever missed a meeting because of a poetry reading, Michael.
I'm pretty sure I still got that nailed down. Yeah, when you first join the fire department there, you're on a six-month period of probation, and one of the stipulations of that period is you must attend all meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you miss a meeting, you have to stand up in front of everybody at the next meeting and tell them where you were. And so I always say that my excuse engendered a certain extemporaneous discussion of the arts.
How is New Auburn faring these days?
Well, New Auburn is in the midst of some change, and my wife and I actually got married. I was a bachelor for 39 years, and then I wrote a book called Truck, A Love Story, where I talk about resurrecting a truck and accidentally getting married. And after that, we bought a farm that's in a little different fire district, so I'm living out on a farm now.
Mm.
But I still get back to New Auburn very regularly. And recently, I have a line in the book where I say the train doesn't stop here anymore. And that's no longer true because they've become part of this very active sand mining having to do with the fracking industry, industry springing up there, which, of course, has caused the usual concerns on both sides. But so things are more active there. On the other hand, the population is actually, it went up a little bit after I left, and now it's on its way back down again. And I still see my buddies on the fire department, and Bob the One-Eyed Beagle and I hung out in the beer tent at Jamboree Days last year. So.
Tell us about
my neighbors first. Yeah.
Tell us about the One-Eyed Beagle here.
Well, he's a buddy of mine. I've known him ever since I was a little kid. I remember riding the school bus with him. He's been on the fire department. He will be the second longest serving member now. He's a butcher. He's severely cross-eyed, and I describe that in the book, and sometimes people think I'm being rude, but I tell folks it's all right. He's well aware. As a matter of fact, he has a joke he likes to tell everybody
yes.
he meets about how he came to be cross-eyed, and I'm not entirely certain we can tell it on the radio, but it's in the book.
Well, you tell a very funny story. You tell a story about bumping into him in the middle of the night once when you were called out to head off somewhere, and you open up the door, and there he is, and you about jumped out of your boots.
Yeah, you know, he's got a big wad of Kodiak going, and he's as cross-eyed as can be. And even though he's a longtime friend, you know, that's a startling thing to see at 3 a.m. from 2 p.m.
Again, we're visiting with Michael Perry about his new book, Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. Your new book, Visiting Tom, is about an 82-year-old man named Tom Hartwig. What prompted you to write about him, Michael?
You know, I was 48 years old and working on my fourth memoir in 10 years. And I thought, man, I know that's what the publisher wants, and I'm glad that they're calling. I'm happy to write for them, but, man, I don't have that much to say. So what? It's a memoir, but it was the first time where I was really able to turn the lens outward more.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom is my 82-year-old neighbor, and what I wanted to write, he's a jack of all trades. He can fix anything. He's got a giant lathe that dates back to the 1918s, and he can make anything on there for you. He welds. He's got a blacksmith shop. He was a farmer. He knows how to drive oxen. And yet I didn't want to write that book where I turn him into something he's not, like he's my mentor and I'm his acolyte and I seek all wisdom from him.
Yeah.
What I wanted to write is, what can you learn from a guy being his neighbor and just going over to get your, you know, like I go over there to get my snowplow welded when I knock it crooked. There is some history in that when my wife was young, she worked on his hay crew, and her family was going through a rough patch, and Tom and his wife provided her a certain amount of shelter as well.
You know, I just love guys like Tom who know so much important stuff like that. I've always admired people like that.
Yeah, and his sense of humor is a blast, because I tell the story in the book. We have a few animals, and I plant little patches of wheat and oats and corn, and I harvest the oats and wheat with an old scythe I got. A buddy bought it for me at an auction. And so I studied up on scythes and how to use them and how to sharpen them. And one day I'm over at Tom's, and I notice he has an old scythe. So I'm pumping him for all this information about scythes. And inside I'm thinking, you know, he's getting I'm getting warm and fuzzy because I'm thinking, oh, he's so happy that someone from the younger generation studying the old ways, carrying it forward. And at one point, he just interrupts me and says, well, you know what else works good? And I said, oh, what is it? And I'm ready to hear this great wisdom. And he said, one of them gas-powered weed whackers.
It takes so all the romance out of it.
He's not lumbered with a lot of sentimentality.
Tell us about his shop.
Well, his shop is indescribable. I kind of tried to describe it in terms of, I think I said something along the lines of it was decorated by Rube Goldberg and rearranged by a stick of dynamite, and also fitted by Hunter Thompson, because he makes one of his favorite hobbies, and I read about this in the book, is he makes his own cannons and shoots them. And he also makes his own black powder, which I say is a slightly extra legal proposition, but if he gets nervous about the ATF coming to bust him for his illegal powder operation, why, he just takes a slash of the moonshine he makes at home.
Why does he make his own cannons, Michael?
You know, he's a history buff, and that even the use of the word buff isn't fair to him. He is one of these fascinating autodidacts. He reads voraciously. He can make anything, but when he got to building cannons, and I write about it in the book a little bit, he got interested as a child, and his mom bought him a book about Civil War history and the history of cannons and catapults, and so he started building these things. And he just shot the one the other day for some friends of mine. It's got a 300-pound barrel. I mean, we're not talking about a little lawn ornament.
What did he aim at?
I don't rush to point out that it's a love story, too. It's a book about he and his wife, Arlene, and they're trying to make it to their 60th wedding anniversary. And Arlene isn't well, and it's not clear if she'll make it. You can imagine that it takes a certain kind of wife to be married to a man like that.
Yes,
well,
that's right. What did Tom Hartwig shoot his cannon at the other day?
He has a 200 yards out, he's got a giant piece of plywood. He paints it white, and then he scribes big red bullseyes on it using house or barn paint. And he props that up in the tree line, and then he just rolls out that cannon and fires away. Actually, the cannon points out of his shed, and then you off towards that target. But you have to, in order to get to his house, you have to drive up his driveway, and you have to drive between the target and the cannon. And one time some salesman came up and he said, Tom, it's hard to drive up your driveway with that cannon sitting there. And Tom said, oh, I never shoot at anyone coming up the driveway.
Does he ever hit his target?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, he was so proud the other day he had a bunch of people over for Memorial Day there, and he hit it 3 out of 4 times, which is pretty remarkable. The things, you know, he said usually he hits it more like 1 out of 4.
There's a 4-lane highway that cuts Tom's farm in half. How does that scramble things for him?
Well, pretty profoundly. And ultimately, I'm a guy, I'm writing stories and trying to make a living. I'm a self-employed writer, and that's how I feed the kids and pay the mortgage. But I'm also trying to learn something when I write a book. And the thing I think that I learned from Tom, I would say if there was a theme to the book, it's about equanimity, because he had this beautiful place. He's lived under that roof for 82 years. And it was a beautiful, isolated farm. He'd run off the porch, past the barn, down to the creek, and play along the creek, and walk to the one-room school, and across a footbridge. And he lived there all his life, and then he just had taken the farm over from his father when the state and the national government put an interstate right through his barnyard. As a matter of fact, they were going to knock his barn over, but he that's the only battle he won. And he went from living in this isolated, bucolic spot to today, he's got 22,500 vehicles a day rolling through his yard at 70 miles an hour and over 8.5 million a year. And he's not happy about that. It's been, those cars came in the late 60s and they haven't stopped since. And yet, despite his grumbling, and I write about some of his grumbling in the book because it's pretty entertaining, but he has gone on to live this full, rich, engaged life in the presence of this. I mean, if you sit at his kitchen table, which my wife and I were just over there visiting him yesterday, the traffic doesn't even stop, and you can feel the faint tremors of the heavy trucks, and it's just one vehicle after another. And yet, he's grinning, telling stories, showing people his cannon, and planting his garden, and raising his honeybees, and he's just an active, engaged guy. And so, I tried to learn from Tom, and a profound disruption like that, and he still has found a way to live with it.
You know, Michael, why was he able to sort of accept this in the way that he did?
Well, that's part of the mystery, and that's what I'm looking for always. Yeah. And I think, you know, he's one of these guys, he fought it tooth and nail, and then when he realized that the battle was over and he'd won an inch, but that was about it, he just decided he had a decision to make. He could be bitter for the rest of his life, or he could say, okay, that battle's over and I lost. And there's a funny little side story that developed when I wrote the book that I never anticipated, but during the process of talking to Tom about the history of this interstate coming through, the local highway commissioner decided to redesign our road in a way that made it very difficult to get to our house. And this becomes almost a comic side story to Tom's because it echoes everything he went through, only on a much smaller and more comical level. Yeah. But it was something that upset me, and I went to meetings, and I went through the process, and I lost. But having already learned Tom's history helped me deal with the fact that, okay, we did what we could, we lost, and now we have to just put some scope on it and move on.
Well, Mike, I've got to ask you, how does Tom like the fame that you've given him through your new book?
Well, I asked his permission before I wrote the book, and he had only one request, and that was that I change his last name.
Oh.
And I've done that. I've done that, although anybody within 70 miles knows immediately who it is the minute you start reading it.
It's the guy with the cannon, right?
That's right. It's the guy that 22,500 vehicles a day drive past his cannon target. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to hide him. But and he's been good about it. I went through the book with him to try and get all the facts straight as best we could. The only issue I've had with him is that he's the one who asked me to, you know, in the nonfiction memoir field, there have been some controversies about veracity. And so I make mistakes and I make errors, but I do my best to pin down the facts. And I sat down with Tom several times and went through the entire book. And then I found out from his daughter there were a couple of things that weren't right, but he was afraid to tell me because he didn't want to hurt my feelings. And so I sat down with him again. I said, Tom, you have to tell me these things. It's very important. So anyway, we got these things fixed. But then right at the end, I said, Tom, it's going off to the printer. You know, anything else that we need to change, anything that's wrong? And he said, no, it's good. And then he said, and I'm just telling people, you changed my name, so I'm just telling them it's fiction anyway.
Whatever.
Get me on Oprah, and for all the wrong reasons. But no, he's been fine. And it's isolated enough here that he really hasn't been bothered. It's mostly been, he was in the hospital for a little stretch over the winter, and several of the nurses asked him to sign the book, and he got a real kick out.
I bet. Well, Michael Perry's new book is Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. And if this book is as good as Population 485, then I can't recommend it enough. It's just he's a terrific writer. And, Michael, I sure appreciate you taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me. And people can visit and learn more at sneezingcow.com.
Sneezingcow.com. That's right. I've been on that site as well. Michael, thanks again, man.
Thanks for having me. You bet. Bye.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our journey through Steve's bookshelf, some books I'm looking forward to reading this summer. We'll turn next to the search for the final doughboys of World War I. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, with next year marking the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, our final book today as we search through Steve's bookshelf is The Last of the Doughboys and author Richard Rubin's search for the final survivors of World War I. Richard Rubin is the author of Confederacy of Silence, and he's written for The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and The New Yorker. And Richard, so good to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How did you get the idea of tracking down all these World War I veterans?
You know, it came out of a radio show very much like this one that I was listening to early in 2003. I was supposed to be working on another book, and I was procrastinating, and there was a gentleman on the radio that day talking about the World War II generation. And he said that World War II veterans were dying off at the rate of 1,000 a day, and we needed to get their stories right away while we still could. And that certainly spoke to me. I appreciated that very much. But on that day, I thought, you know, I know a lot of World War II stories, but I haven't heard very many World War I veterans tell their stories. And I wondered if there were still any left to talk to. And I did the math. It was 2003, as I said. I knew it was 85 years from the armistice, so somebody who was 20 years old in 1918 would be 105 in 2003. And I thought, well, there won't be many of them, but maybe I'll find two or three.
And you found them, and a few more on top of that, right?
I did. I ended up interviewing several dozen men and women. They ranged in age from 101 to 113.
How did you find them, and how good of interviews were they at that point in their lives?
Well, finding them was actually very difficult. I naively thought that there'd be some sort of list that maybe the Department of Veterans Affairs would have. They would share it with me. They didn't have any such list. I tried calling VFW, American Legion posts, local VA hospitals, nursing homes. Nobody had seen a World War I veteran, they said, in at least 10 years. And I got my big break, finally, from the government of France, which in 1998, so 5 years earlier, had instituted a program wherein they would award the Legion of Honor, their highest military honor, to any living American veteran who had served on French soil during World War I. And they'd given out about 550 of these, and they graciously shared their list with me. And even so, upwards of 90% of the people on that list had since passed away. But it was the first break I got in the case. Regarding your question about how good were the interviews,
that
was my other concern going into it. I figured maybe 10% of people that age would be able to recall things that they had done 85 years ago. But I didn't understand who I was dealing with. Centenarians are not like the rest of us. They're the only way to put it is they're genetic super people. They age more slowly than the rest of us do. They're immune to things like dementia and Alzheimer's that take down a lot of us. And their memories were fantastic, especially their older memories. You know, memory is an interesting thing. When you get to that age, it's a matter of first in, last out. And so they could remember very clearly things that they had done 80, 90, even 100 years earlier. But they often couldn't tell you what they'd had for breakfast that morning.
That's like me. that's exactly.
Yeah, me too.
I get home at the end of the day sometimes. My wife says, well, who was on the show today? And I'm already thinking about tomorrow's show. I forgot about today. It's funny how your brain works that way, you know?
Yeah. And yeah. Without that, of course, this wouldn't have been possible. But it worked that way, and it was very fortunate for me that it did.
Yeah. You know, was it difficult at all to get them to open up to you? Because, you know, sometimes, you know, war veterans simply don't want to talk about their experiences.
You know, that's what you think going into it, and that's certainly understandable. But, again, perhaps I was fortunate that I got to these people as late as I did, strange as that sounds, because what I found was that not only were they willing to talk to me, to my great surprise, but they were actually eager to talk.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many times somebody would stop in the middle of a great story and say, you know, I haven't talked about this in 60, 70 years. And they really seem to be almost grateful to have the opportunity to talk about it once again. And I would ask them sometimes, well, why not? And sometimes the answer was really surprising to me. They said nobody asked.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. You know, so what was I should point out, too, that all the doughboys now, they're all deceased, right?
That's right. The last one, native of your area, Frank Buckles.
Frank Buckles, yeah.
In Harrison County, he died February 27th, 2011, at the age of 110.
Wow. Well, so what did you hear from them? How did your image of World War I change as a result of doing the interviews you did?
Well, you know, there's a difference between reading about something in a book and sitting there and talking to somebody who lived it. It's not just the detail that they invest in the story as much as just the sense that you realize that you're looking at somebody. It's a matter of continuity, really. You're looking at somebody who was there. The first gentleman I interviewed was a 107-year-old man named Anthony Piero, who had served in an artillery unit. He was an Italian immigrant, had come here in 1914 and had been drafted in 1918 and sent over to France. And he was telling me stories about battle stories, about one time his life was saved by a horse, actually, which took shrapnel from a shell and spared him. And another time a shell, he took cover during a bombardment under a tree, and a shell landed in the branches of the tree and didn't explode. And while I was talking to him, these images would flash through my mind of the sepia-toned, old, sped-up, silent movies you've seen of doughboys charging over the top and mm-hmm. going forward. And I realized that this man could have been in one of those films. It's really a remarkable thing. But, I was very fortunate. I thought maybe I would get to interview two or three people, and I wasn't sure how much of a picture of the war I would get. In the end, I really spoke to people from across the broad spectrum of America's experience of that war. You know, people, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, people who went to France, people who served behind the lines, people who were on the home front. It fleshed out for me a picture of the war that I never really had before. You know, our images of World War I tend to be very romantic in a way.
Yes.
Be it as a kind of a dashing time, and I think in part because those old movies are silent and those old photos are sepia toned, and the picture that a lot of these people painted was of a very, very nasty business in a way. The war was not dashing, and it was not pleasant.
Well, the violence, the level of violence was just almost unspeakable, wasn't it? It just went on and on and on, and just horrific scenes after horrific scenes.
Yes, you know, it was a meat grinder,
yeah.
And, trench warfare, well, all I have to say about trench warfare is that it was so awful that it's never happened again.
Yeah.
And
you're talking about this idea of men actually digging trenches and fighting from those vantage points to enemies who also have dug trenches, and in some cases those trenches didn't move, you know, for months at a time. You can see a great example of a trench at the National World War I Museum right here in Kansas City.
Yeah, and they were, you know, they were muddy. They were full of rats and lice. The water table in France was never very deep. So there was, you know, they were collapsing all the time. And it was just really a dirty business. And, we tend to forget that because we do think about it as something that happened so long ago, and things tend to clean up at that kind of distance. But, terrible stories that people shared, too, about getting gassed, or one gentleman had bombs dropped on him by a German airplane, a low-flying German airplane. Another one was...
How did he survive that?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. He went to the he was sent to the hospital for several months, and they wanted to send him home. And he said he was young. He was 17 years old. He'd lied about his age to enlist. And he begged them not to send him home. He said, I didn't see how the war started, but I want to see how it ends. And they sent him back to the front a few weeks before the war ended. And he did see how it ended. And for the rest of his life, I think he wished he hadn't. I think he wished he had let them send him home. Mm-hmm. When they wanted to. Another gentleman, also from Missouri, the other part of the state, he was originally from Hannibal, that area, he was a machine gunner, and he was sitting on a dirt rise talking to a friend sitting 2 feet away, and a German sniper killed the man. Mm-hmm. And, I met him 85 years later, and he still clearly had not gotten over it. He kept saying, you know, he picked him instead of me. You know, his life in that moment came down to a coin toss, and for the remaining 86 years of that life, he carried that around with him.
We're visiting with Richard Rubin about his new book, The Last of the Doughboys. Richard, how did you manage to take these dozen or so stories and then sort of, you know, weave them together in what's a very cohesive narrative here?
Well, you know, it's really a couple of dozen stories, and it you let the stories kind of dictate the narrative in a way. Some of the people in the book get their own chapter because their stories just merit it, and other people are put together with others of sort of a similar theme in their own chapter. And the book loosely follows a chronological arc of America's involvement in the war. But, of course, everybody has complete stories to tell. So what you take is the part of the story that stands out the most for you, and then you use that to plug it into the timeline. That gentleman I told you about who was nearly killed by a German airplane, the most dramatic part of his story occurred on the last night of the war. And so I save his story for near the end of the book because chronologically that's where it made the most sense.
You know, Richard, you spent 10 years working on this book. Why did it take you so long?
Well, the first few years were devoted entirely to tracking down and interviewing these veterans.
Because mm-hmm. You knew you had to go quickly, I'm sure. Time was of the essence there, right?
Yes, yes. And you know, sometimes I lost that race. There were people I learned about, and I didn't get to them in time. There was one gentleman in Las Vegas. Who I learned about. I booked a ticket that day for 2 weeks hence, and when I got to Las Vegas, he was unconscious in the hospital and died the next morning. So that was the first few years, was just a scramble to find these people and get their stories as quickly as I could. And then once I had the stories in hand, I had to do a tremendous amount of research to put those stories in context. You know, it was a backwards process in a way. You know, typically you do the research first and then you go out and find people you can talk to and ask them questions about that. But unfortunately, I didn't have the luxury of doing that. But, you know, World War I is a huge subject and terribly important in this country's history, and it was very important to me to get it right. So the research was probably the biggest phase of the process.
Richard Rubin's new book is titled The Last of the Doughboys. And, Richard, it's been just a pleasure to have you. And best of luck with the book. And thank you for taking time with us here in Kansas City today. Are you coming out here today at any point to visit the museum out here and to speak at the museum?
Well, I would love to. I'm a great fan of the museum, and I hope to be out there sometime soon. I just want to mention that if people are interested in seeing video clips of some of these interviews, including that gentleman talking about the time a German sniper killed his friend, you can find them at the book's website, thelastofthedoughboys.com.
All right, thelastofthedoughboys.com. Richard, thanks again. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You know, so many great books, so little time. Next month we'll do one more version of Steve's Bookshelf because there's so many books I'm interested in these days.